I don't know about you, if you had an opportunity to be formed when you were younger through like a boys' organization or a girls' organization, but I was a part of the American Boy Scouts. And this was a really, it has been ruined in recent years by all kinds of leftist influences that are not, they don't even call it Boy Scouts anymore, they call it Scouts. And so they've, but it was really a great organization when I was a young boy, because it helped prepare men, young boys to be men. And do any of you know the motto of the Boy Scouts?
Be prepared.
That's it. Be prepared. Be prepared. And the sign is to put three fingers up like that. So we would all salute one another this way. Be prepared. And I remember as a young boy, like 10 years old, I'm thinking, well, be prepared for what? And I learned that actually the be prepared applies to lots of things in life. But ultimately, be prepared for manhood. Be prepared to handle life like a man, not like a boy. And do what you can to prevent more catastrophe than could happen in your life. Be prepared for the hurricanes that would come in life. Now, last time I was teaching this book of Numbers, where I used this same phrase, be prepared for Numbers, the U.S. was preparing for Hurricane Irma that was descending on the East Coast. You know, and the cry in Florida was, prepare, Irma's coming. Irma's coming. And indeed, it just descended on Florida with a vengeance. I think it was one of the worst hurricanes that ever had hit Florida. And they were crying for days before, the leaders, the governor, etc., be prepared. And some people really were prepared. They boarded up their stalls. They left the area, and they really heeded the message. But others didn't, and some people lost their lives as a result of not really being prepared. You know, God prepares us to serve Him, but how does He actually do that? Think of all the preparation that you endured to get to today. And think, well, how did God prepare me to serve Him today? Just before class, I was talking to Dr. Justin, our newest faculty member who began teaching last night. And I asked him how it went. And he said, yeah, it went pretty well. I said, have you thought about how much time it took for you to get to this point? I mean, most people, they'll prepare for a year or two or something like that to get into their job. Obviously, more than that. Depends on the job. But I said, I didn't start teaching here until after I got my PhD at age 32. I was 33 when I came. And he said, well, actually, I'm 33 this year myself. And I said, think about that, 33 years of preparation for you to be a professor. But how many years of preparation does it take really to serve the Lord really effectively? I feel like I'm still being prepared. And so I said, you know, I came at age 33 with the goal to stay to 65. So if I could stay here at the college for 32 years, that'd be wonderful. I haven't quite reached it yet. I'm at 28 now. I still need four more years to reach that. And hopefully, back when I was in my 30s, the retirement age was 65. Now it's 70. By the time I get to 70, it's probably 75. You know, I don't know. But in any case, it does take, if you're going to do something worthy of the Lord, it does take a long time. And we need to be looking to others ahead of us. And so I said to Dr. Justin, I said, do you know who Dr. Polson was? And he didn't really know. But I said, he's the one who actually established his school of theology English back in 1953 was when he came to Singapore. And he served for 64 years here in Singapore as a missionary. Now, honestly, I've never heard of anyone who served 64 years as a missionary in any country. probably there's more than who served longer than that, but he prepared well, and he was being prepared as he was going along. And I think about preparation, I think about the book of Numbers. That's our key word for book of Numbers, preparation. And specifically, preparation to occupy the land. I'm not sure I like that word occupy anymore. I keep changing my phrases for these books. Because occupy even does, it implies something a bit different now. That Israel's occupying the land, but they don't really have a right to the land. It's just occupation, you know? So I might have to change that for Numbers and also for Joshua, where our key word is going to be occupation. You know, that they were occupying the land. Now, ultimately, the land belonged to God. That's true. But we see that God had given Abraham that promise to bring them back after 400 years and to bring them into the land. And when we talked about Exodus, we saw that the Lord brought Israel out in around April of 1445 B.C. What we'll see by the time we begin the book of Numbers is this about a year later, because Leviticus only takes about 1 month time, and they had been brought down to Mount Sinai for a year where they were preparing to enter the land. So the book of Numbers is the one that we use to help us see what happened to Israel in the wilderness. Some people use, for the book of Numbers, they use the key word wilderness. Not a bad key word, because the whole book takes place in the wilderness. I like to think that there's a theological purpose, though, for Israel being in the wilderness. And that theological purpose primarily is that God was preparing them. It took 39 years, because the book of Numbers takes place after the 1 year at Mount Sinai, putting the tabernacle together for Israel, under getting the law from God and understanding what God was expecting of them. They weren't really ready to move out. In a sense, I could say that Exodus and Leviticus were God preparing them as well. But where they had come from prior to Numbers is that God had delivered them from Goshen, and we see these various locations that brought them all the way to Mount Sinai. And they were at Mount Sinai for that. So this is the geographical start of Numbers. We'll see in the book that they leave Sinai, they go to Kadesh Barnea to enter the land of Canaan from the south, but they're unwilling to let the Lord bring them into the land. So God brings them on a 39-year detour, 38 years and some months, actually, 38 years, 3 months or so. And that occupies the great portion of the book of Numbers in the middle, until the book finally ends across from Israel to the east at Moab. All right, so the book shows three different aspects of God preparing them to enter the land and get the inheritance that God had prepared for them. And because it takes 39 years or so, we actually have an old generation that begins the book and the new generation that ends the book. And then that center section of the book is basically the old generation, one by one, is dying off. I can't remember, someone calculated once, if you got about 2 million people and they die off in about 30 years, you have something like 450 funerals a day. I can't remember how many it was. It was something like 400 and something funerals a day. Well, that's basically what they're doing. We don't see any of these funerals in the book except for Aaron's funeral, Miriam's funeral. And Moses doesn't die in Numbers. He still has some messages to preach in Deuteronomy, okay? So we got to let him get to Deuteronomy. But that's the basic overview of the book. And throughout all of it, God is faithful to do everything he said he was going to do. The problem was not God. The problem wasn't that God was very slow in accomplishing his will in Israel's life. The problem was Israel would not let the Lord really have a first place. And so this is really a book of God's faithfulness contrasted with Israel's faithlessness, or if Israel actually under discipline from the Lord. And so what is our key word for Numbers? Preparation. It's preparation. It's sort of like setting up a chess board. You're not actually beginning the game yet, but you're getting all the pieces in order. And this is what the Lord does. He puts all the pieces in order. And the book of Numbers is referred to several times in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians 10 talks about water coming from a rock and how God was faithful to provide water from a rock. Now, if you want to go get water, I would advise you not to go to a rock. It's kind of the last place you're going to find water, right? But God provides for us in the most unusual places, and we see the Lord doing that. He even has them wear the same sandals for 40 years. You got it? You know, you're a 15-year-old, and your parents die off. 40 years later, you're wearing the same sandals. Now, I'm in my 60s, but I can assure you, the shoes I'm wearing, I didn't wear in my 20s. I haven't been able to keep the same shoes for four decades. But God, that's just one way that the Lord provided for them. And Numbers gives wisdom. We see in 2 Timothy 3:15, from infancy that Timothy, Paul says about Timothy, you've known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith in Christ Jesus. Numbers teaches, it encourages us, as Paul says in Romans 15:4. For everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through endurance and encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope. And when you get into this book, you realize, well, this is about Israel, but in a sense, it's not just about Israel. God giving birth to the people of Israel, it's actually about us as well. Not only Numbers, but Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers are all used in the New Testament as the New Testament's looking back, and it's helping us with the theology of these books to understand if we don't quite catch it in the book itself. Let's see, what was our keyword for Exodus? Formation, yeah. We should go back one more. Genesis? Election. That's the easy one because we've said it so many times, right? So God elected a people, and then he begins to form the people in Exodus. Now they need to know how to live a holy life before the Lord. So we have the book of Leviticus where the key word is sanctification. Yeah. So sanctification has the idea of what? Set apart. So God says, I'm forming you into my special people, and I'm setting you apart as a special nation. Unlike the other nations, God did not have this same relationship with the other nations. He didn't give the other nations his law. He didn't put his spirit living in a tabernacle in any of the other nations. They had a very unique place before God. It's not because God was a racist that he picked the Jews. It was because God wanted to reveal himself to the nation of Israel so they could be a blessing to all nations. And that's where we come in. And now as we see, when we get to Numbers, that God was preparing them to actually move on in from Mount Sinai, move on up and go on into the land. Sadly, though, they didn't go into the land. We know that these books are actually depicting for us a similar, you might say, birth of a nation. The New Testament says that we, in 1 Peter, that you are a chosen people, a holy nation. In a sense, God looks at us as like a nation that he also forms through salvation. And we understand that Exodus, the formation that God brings, the deliverance from Egypt, and the beginning to form as a people, God does for us by Exodus being a picture of salvation for us. as Israel was saved from the slavery in Egypt, so we have been saved from the slavery of sin. We have been delivered, is really what the idea of Exodus is talking about, salvation. And then God has saved us to what? To instruct us, as we see in Leviticus. God instructs us, so instruction is really where we're at. After people are saved, they need to be instructed, right? They need to learn how to live a holy life. Over and over we see in Leviticus, God says, be holy because I am holy. So instruction in a holy life. And then that will go throughout life. And so the walk of the believer is depicted in the book of Numbers. Israel's walking with the Lord. They're learning to know what God's requirements are in the book of Numbers. They're learning how faithful He is and how faithless they are. But they're learning how to put in practice what the Lord has already taught them in Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. And likewise, the walk of the believer is oftentimes in the New Testament compared to the book of Numbers. Looking ahead, we'll get past Deuteronomy. We'll look to Joshua. And the word will be occupation, which is probably a key word that I probably should change, because nowadays Israel occupying the land kind of has lots of different connotations. It implies that they're really not fulfilling God's purposes. And there's no right, that they have no right to the land, even though God had given them that right to this land for eternity. The purpose of Joshua is to help them see that that God desired to give them rest. We find that they only had a partial rest, though. When we look back on the book of Joshua later on in the Old Testament, Psalm 95 says that God wanted to bring them, Joshua wanted to bring them into rest, but they really didn't have a rest, and there's a future rest to come. That's your little teaser, okay, for understanding what the book of Hebrews is talking about in terms of God's rest. Well, I'll say that until that point. Okay, so there's kind of overview of where we've gone and where we are now and where we're going. Does that elicit any questions, or is there any confusion there? Any questions you want to bring up? Comments? Yes.
Nation was set apart for God.
Okay. What does set apart mean?
Yeah, so how does it apply to nowadays as Christians? Because we don't have a nation. So we are like scattered around the world. So what does it mean for us to be set apart?
What does it mean for believers to be set apart? Well, they, even as they were set apart and God was putting them in a certain location, they were still in the context of all kinds of pagan nations. They were to clear out the land. We'll see when we get to Joshua. But in a sense, it's like us as believers. We live within an unsaved community, but God wants us to have our values different than them. He wants it so that a Christian's lifestyle should not look like the lifestyle of the world in terms of what they value. I think of this especially in terms of 1 Peter, verse 1 of 1 Peter. Peter says, I write to you as aliens living in Pontus, Bithynia, Cappadocia, you know, Asia. And Peter's writing people who are living in their home area, but he calls them aliens. If you feel like an alien, even though you're a Singaporean living within your own country, do you feel like an alien? How many of you Singaporeans feel like aliens? None of you, really? I'll tell you, when I go back to America, I feel like an alien. When I'm in Singapore, I feel like an alien. I feel like my values do not match the Singapore values. They just do not. My values do not match the American values. The values of independence, self-reliance, I don't need God. Materialism. I don't spend the time doing the materialistic things that most of my people do. the whole focus, especially for me at my age, you know, all my friends and my family, everybody's just, the whole focus is on retirement. It's almost like they've already retired. Retired from focusing on whatever, their job and ministry and all that. And everybody's just trying to save as much as they can for the future. That's the whole goal. I feel like if I'm really walking with Jesus, I'm going to trust the Lord for my retirement. I'm going to save. Don't get the idea. I don't save anything for retirement. But I think that's the idea of being holy. It means other people are not, they don't have a concern for holiness. Does that make sense? I mean, how many of your non-Christian neighbors have a concern for holiness? How many Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, so-called free thinkers ever say to you, boy, I just really want to live a holy life? Have you ever had such a person say such a thing to you? I have never. Not that it wouldn't happen, but I've never had a non-Christian ever say that sort of thing to me. I hardly have any Christians say that thing to me, let alone non-Christians. So, yeah. Did I answer the question? All right. That's a great question. So, how to sum up the book of Numbers? God's faithful preparation of his people to enter Canaan contrasts with Israel's unbelieving rebelliousness. How's that for, you know, should Israel be proud? This unbelieving rebelliousness in the wilderness to teach the nation his unconditional commitment to fulfill his Abrahamic covenant. In other words, if the Abrahamic covenant was based on Israel's faithfulness and their obedience and their loving the Lord and all this, then never, God wouldn't have fulfilled his promise. It just underscores for us that the Abrahamic covenant is a unilateral or a one-way or an unconditional promise. In fact, God's just so obvious about all this in some points. He just says, you guys are just the most stubborn nation of all. You're worse than all the others, but, you know, I made this promise to you. I'm going to stick with you. So the book talks about how God prepared Israel to serve him, to be his representatives in the land. And there's a parallel to us as well, how God prepares us to serve him. And I tried to spell it out more in a preaching way here to say there's three ways, and here's the first one. God organizes us to be holy. What we see the Lord doing in the first part of the book, first four chapters, as we have on this one, or first 10 chapters, from 1:1 to 10:10, is God prepares the old generation. All right? He organizes them, he sanctifies them. We see this as we begin the book in Numbers 1. It starts off with organization. And I don't have the details, I don't have the time to get into all the details on this, but he basically tells them, here's where each one of the tribes lives. And once you march out, here's the order everybody follows. 2 million people moving through the desert. You got to be pretty organized to do that. He even has them count how many soldiers they have, men of military age, in chapter 2. And it shows that there's 603,550 of them from the various tribes. Now, that's men, okay, of ages, what, 20 to 50, I think it is. Doesn't include women, doesn't include children, doesn't even include the Levites. You add another 22,000 for the Levites. That's a lot of people. Conservative estimates would be that we've got about 2 million people if there's 600,000 men. There is actually a large enough place right next to Mount Sinai to fit 2 million people there. And God spells out who's supposed to live where. Interesting thing is the highest number of tribes live to the east of the tabernacle, Judah, Issachar, and Benjamin, and Zebulun. And if you kind of depicted it in pictorial form, you'd actually You could stretch it all out, and it's almost like you've really got a cross here, because the same number of people live to the north and the south of the tabernacle, 150,000 or so, compared to those in the west and the east. It's almost like, I want to ask the Lord about this sometime. Did you mean to have a cross formation here? You know, the tabernacle, the orientation of the tabernacle toward the east. It's not toward the north like we might think, because people would enter the tabernacle from the east. And God spells out in Numbers 3 exactly where the various, the Levites and the priests are to live, close to the tabernacle. Gershonites to the west, Kohathites to the south, Merarites to the north. And we see the Lord is organizing all of these people. He's organizing the Levitical family, the priests, and others who are Levites to provide for his people. Yes, he disciplined Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus, but there's still Eleazar and Ithamar left of Aaron's sons. So the priesthood continues. God has organized all of that. And then Numbers 4 puts the two together, where you've got the priests living close to the tabernacle, which makes sense, and then the various tribes living all around. That's why I live the next building right over. You know, we're in block one right now. I live in block two, so I'm like a priest. You know, living south of west of this building here. I'm just kidding, of course. But in Numbers 5, we see the Lord giving these laws of sanctification, going up to 10. He tells them how they're supposed to live, laws of cleanliness, etc. He says that the Lord sought to bless them. In fact, he tells the priests, this is how you are to bless the people. At the end of number 6, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift his countenance upon you and give you peace. That's the blessing of the priests on the people. Isn't that great? It's not, oh, you better follow the Lord, otherwise he's going to zap you, you know. It's no, God has this desire to bless you. Live in accordance with what he says. He's prepared everything you need. Follow him. And the people respond in number 7. It's a long chapter, but it shows that each one of the tribes end up coming to the tabernacle that's newly constructed, and they all bring really the same offering, the same number of animals, the same number, the amount of gold, etc. And they all participate in this equally, even though the tribes are of different sizes. Moving on, basically the idea is follow God's direction instead of your own way to order your own life. If you want to, if you just recognize how God has prepared you, I think you'd be amazed to see actually what he's actually done in your life. Just think about it. Susan and I, we often think about the many hundreds of people who have come and gone over our years here in Singapore, and how the Lord has preserved us. We've seen people leave because they didn't have enough money. Singapore has become so expensive. We've seen fellow missionaries leave because of health. We've seen others leave because their children weren't making it. One of our friends, they just pulled their teenage daughter out of Singapore and brought them back to the U.S. because she was dating the wrong guy, and that just ended their missionary career. We've seen others leave Asia and go back to take care of aging parents, and yet we have siblings that have cared for our parents, and so many ways we see that God has prepared us to serve him over the years. He's also prepared us, helped us to not be overwhelmed with the amount of work here. I speak to you non-Singaporeans. You will have a hard time finding a lazy Singaporean. I'm honest here. I mean, I just don't know. I know some Singaporeans who get crushed and have emotional issues and are not, you know, I mean, that happens in every society. It certainly happens here. But I tell you, please be organized. You will be able to accomplish more for the Lord Jesus if you're organized. When I was in seminary, one of my teachers said, if you're looking for a piece of paper and it takes you more than 5 minutes, you need to redo your filing system. Well, that really hit me. Yeah, you know, some stuff. Sometimes, oh yeah, I would love to have that piece of paper, but it's in a box somewhere, and it's going to take me maybe a couple days to find it, you know? And if that describes you, you need to redo your filing system. Now, a lot of our filing is digital. But do you know what? You can be totally disorganized on your computer as well. I have 1.2 million files on my computer here. I better know where they are, how to find them. And that little search feature, what's that?
Thank God for search.
Yeah, the search feature doesn't always, their search feature's got to keep up. It's got to keep indexing, and a lot of times it doesn't work. Sometimes I'm looking at the file itself, and then I say search for it, and it can't find it. I'm going, it's right there. I'm pointing right to it, you know. Here's the point. God has given you all you need to serve him. God is faithful. God prepared Israel. God has prepared you. So let him work. Let him work through you. And if you need help being organized, get some help. I did a seminar some years back on how to do a filing system. That was back when life was more paper-oriented. Now it's more digitally-oriented. But it's the same idea. You have to think in terms of categories and that kind of thing. Let God work through you. I love Philippians 2:13. For God's working in you, giving you the desire and the power to do what pleases him. This is my verse to those who say, yeah, I just don't want to. I know I should do this, but I just don't want to. I go, well, how about claiming Philippians 2:13? God gives us the want to. Now, here's a question. Do you want to ask God to give you the want to? If you don't even want to ask God to give you the want to, what can I say? But God does want to give you the desire to serve him. And if we come to the point where we say, Lord, I don't even want to do this IBS. I don't even like doing this IBS. Would you give me the desire to do it? You know what? If it's God's plan in your life, I've prayed this prayer hundreds of times. Every time God has been faithful to give me the desire to do what he wants me to do. He never fails doing that. So I would encourage you to pray that prayer. Israel needed to pray that prayer. Lord, I'm not so sure I really want to go into the land. I kind of like the security of Mount Sinai. Would you give me the desire to really trust you to go on into the land and face those giants? I bet God would have answered that prayer. But I don't see anybody actually praying that prayer. And on the other side of it, 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, the temptations in your life are no different from what others experience. And God is faithful. He will not allow the temptation to be more than you can stand. When you're tempted, he'll show you a way out so that you can endure. The Lord never allows anything in your life or my life that's too strong for us so we end up having to sin. That's a great comfort to me. A lot of times you think, oh man, I've just got two options. Both of them are sin. No, you don't. No, you don't. There's a third option where you don't sin, you know. In fact, he gives you the strength to do it. You know Philippians 4:13. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. And so that's where Israel was as they get on up to chapter 10. They have seen that the way God prepared them to serve them, first of all, was that he organized them. In fact, he organizes us to be holy. There's also a second one a second way that God prepares us to serve him, and that is, we see in the middle section of the book, God warns us of the cost of unbelief. Honestly, I don't think we have enough warnings today. I find that, well, my sermon for this Sunday is a warning sermon. And I find that by preaching each book of the Bible, then I will warn our people as much as God warns them, if I'm actually preaching what he says. There's a cost, there's a price for not trusting the Lord. And we find in this middle section that Israel ends up paying the price. They leave Mount Sinai and they go to Kadesh, or Kadesh Barnea, in the first part of this middle section, where the basic idea is their privilege of going on into the land is postponed for unbelief. He has them make these silver trumpets. When they blow these trumpets, that show the people that they need to be marching on out. And so they follow the marching order. First tribes heading on out, and the ark leading them, and the tabernacle and the furniture spread along the way. So they leave the wilderness of Paran, and they make their way toward the promised land. And what do? Along the way, complain. Numbers 11. Soon the people began to complain about their hardship, and the Lord heard everything they said. And then the Lord's anger blazed against them, and he sent a fire to rage among them, and he destroyed some of the people in the outskirts of the camp. And then the people screamed to Moses for help, and when he prayed to the Lord, the fire stopped. After that, the area was known as Taberah, which means the place of burning, because fire from the Lord had burned among them there. Here continues their disobedience. We saw the disobedience when they came out of Egypt, complaining to the Lord about food, complaining to the Lord about water. God provided manna. God provided water from a rock. Then they get to Mount Sinai. They complain that God's taking too long, so they build a golden calf. You know, Exodus 32. Wherever and whenever we pick up the account, they're actually complaining along the way. But the Lord's faithful. And Numbers 12 shows that he was faithful to bring them up to Kadesh Barnea. They are at the southernmost part of the land. They're ready to go in. Or are they? At least they've seen God's faithfulness to bring them all the way up there. Here's where we find their sin at Kadesh. I don't know about you, but in my country, 13 is your unlucky number, you know? I know 4 is not the lucky number here in Singapore. 4 is the number of death, right? Yeah. But whatever it takes for you to remember these different chapters, you know? Number 13 is sort of I don't believe in luck, but anyway. They make their way up to Kadesh, and there at Kadesh, did God actually tell them to send spies? I don't think it actually says that the Lord said to send spies. People came to Moses and so he sends, what's that?
The Lord sent to Moses.
The Lord said to Moses,
send some men to explore.
Send some men, okay. It was God's idea. I guess God knew that if these people would go on up, then they'd be able to see the bounty of the land. But what do you actually see? You know, they bring this huge thing of grapes back. It takes 2 men to hold it. And it's just a very visible way for them to be able to see God's provision. And they give their report. The spies return. The majority report says, oh, it's a good land, but there's giants there. And we seem like grasshoppers. You look at the last verse of Numbers 13. It says, we look like grasshoppers in our own eyes, in our own sight. Okay? Because When you're seeing giants as tall as our... I don't think I'd like to do a fight, you know, man-to-man fight against somebody who's tall as the ceiling, you know? If my eyes were on him, I surely would fail. I would feel like a little grasshopper. The funny thing about this is that, look at that verse. It says, we seem like grasshoppers in our own sight, and we seem the same to them. Now, do you think they really did their market research here? Do you think they went up to the giants and they said, now I feel like a grasshopper. I'm doing market research for Israel here. Do you feel like I'm a grasshopper too?
Yeah, you kind of look like a grasshopper.
Yep, there we go. There we go. I got it. Got my data done and my research is finished. And I'll go report back to the people. Yep, we feel like grasshoppers. They say we're grasshoppers. Done deal. We're definitely grasshoppers. You know, grasshoppers, you can just step on that grasshopper and squish them. They're really not being objective, are they? They've gotten that's the majority report. 10 of them. The minority report, Joshua and Caleb say, there's a big G here, but the big G is for, not for, it's not for good or giants or grasshoppers. The big G is for God. God's bigger than the giants. The giant is like a grasshopper in the eyes of God. I'm paraphrasing, you know. But the minority report does not win over the people. And actually, this is just pretty much in accord with what you find throughout the Old Testament. Whenever they sort of take a vote, the majority votes against the will of God. The minority is the one that votes for the will of God. So if you feel like a minority, you're in good company, because there's a lot of people that feel like a minority because they're following the Lord and the majority is going against the Lord. So God says in number 14, he kills the other 10. He says, you guys are not willing. You guys have led the people astray. That very day, those 10 spies die. Joshua and Caleb live through it. And God says, trip canceled. Or maybe more, at least it's canceled right now. It's going to be postponed for 39 more years. Until everyone age 20 and above who would not trust the Lord would die off. Imagine that happening to your local church, where God's led your church to do something, and it's the older folks are just not willing to trust the Lord. God says, okay, your church is just going to tread water for the next 40 years until all those old people die off. And then God says, I'm going to do his will through the young people. Everyone age 20 and younger. If you can put it in a way that we might be able to think about. That means I'm out of here because I'm way over age 20, you know. Actually, everybody here is over age 20, aren't we? Yeah, I don't think we have any students under age 20. And what we have the Lord saying here, I take to be among the key verses of the book. God says, not one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me these 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. The very thing that you cry out, oh God, all our children are going to die in the desert. God says, no, the children are going to live. You're going to die in the desert. The very thing they feared for their children was the thing that actually came upon themselves because they were unwilling to trust the Lord. And so the wilderness of Zin. They march around the wilderness of Zin and the wilderness of Sin. That sounds appropriate, doesn't it? For, 39 more years. One cartoonist says, after 39 and a half years of wandering in the desert, Mrs. Moses secretly asked for directions. They finally, they knew the direction. The direction was north, but they were under divine discipline, and God did not allow them to go on into the land. Here we find the Lord being very severe, but loving in his severity. And it's interesting that Numbers 15 follows right behind this, because God had told them to be trusting him to really take a break on the Sabbath. And Numbers 15, the end of the chapter, records about a man who's caught picking up sticks on the Sabbath. This, and they put him in custody, and they say, Lord, what should we do about this? And God says, this man deserves to die. From our context, we say, wow, that's quite severe. But here's a man who just flagrantly goes against the Lord, and he's actually going to influence the rest of the nation, unless there's some price for him. Numbers 10 looks back on this and says, for anyone who refused to obey the law of Moses was put to death without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. And so this man ends up becoming stoned by the people. This concept is said well in the book on the future reign of the servant kings by Joseph Dillo. I would highly recommend this book, Final Destiny. I'm still in the process of reading it. It's a 1,200-page book, and it's so meaty. Every paragraph, I have to think about it, you know. But he has what he calls the partaker's view, or in other words, only those who are really faithful to the Lord Jesus are the ones who partake in reigning with him. Yes, others are saved, but inheritance, well, I'll tell you his theology of inheritance, which I find is a biblical theology of inheritance in the Old Testament. Dr. Dillo contrasts between inheriting the land of Canaan and living there. The former refers to ownership and the latter to mere residence. I can relate to that. Have I inherited anything in Singapore? Not one square centimeter. But do I have the privilege of living here without owning anything? Yes. I mean, I do own some things. I own this computer, sort of. This half of it is SBC, and this half is my mission organization. But while Israel was promised the inheritance as a nation, the condition for maintaining their inheritance right to the land of Canaan was faith, obedience, and completion of one's task. The promise, while national, was applied only to the believing and obedient remnant. Here's how we can kind of hold in tension this unconditional promise for the nation, but the condition of faithful obedience for those that were going to be able to participate in that. Point three, the inheritance is not to be equated with heaven, but with something in addition to heaven, promised to those believers who faithfully obey the Lord. This is not saying those who didn't go into the land were unsaved. Right? The ones who died off in the wilderness. The text doesn't say anything, oh, these people lost their salvation, or they never were saved, or anything like that. It's just saying they didn't experience the blessing of being in the land. Number four, just as Old Testament believers forfeited their earthly inheritance through disobedience, we can also forfeit our future reward, our inheritance, by a similar failure. Loss of inheritance, however, doesn't mean loss of salvation. So we're upholding the security of the believer still. Point five. Two kinds of inheritance were enjoyed in the Old Testament. All Israelites who believed and were therefore regenerate had God as their inheritance, but not all inherited the land. This paves the way for the concept that the New Testament may also teach two inheritances. We're all heirs of God, but we're not all joint heirs with Christ unless we persevere to the end of life. The former, being an heir of God, refers to our salvation, and the latter to our reward, being a joint heir of Christ, with Christ. Point six, a child of Israel was both an heir of God and an heir of Canaan by virtue of faith in God resulting in regeneration. And yet only those believers in Israel who were faithful would maintain their status as firstborn sons who would actually receive what had been promised to them as an inheritance. Actually paves the way, the Old Testament paves the way for this concept in the New Testament of inheritance. And this concept of, talked about in Romans 8:17, if we're children, then we're heirs, heirs of God. Here's a first type of heir. And co-heirs with Christ, Notice the if following the second one. If indeed we share in his sufferings in order that we may also share in his glory. Being an heir of God, in other words, is different from being a co-heir with Christ. This might be a new kind of a teaching to you, but I think it has a good foundation in the Old Testament. Being an heir of God means you have salvation. But being a co-heir of Christ has a condition. Suffering, in order that we also share in his glory, is referring to reward. Bottom line, not all Christians are going to be rewarded equally. Did you think that all Christians will be rewarded equally?
With salvation, yes.
With salvation, we're equally forgiven from sin. He forgives every one of our sins. But in terms of our future reward of reigning with Jesus, I don't think it's going to be equal. So anyway, we'll unpack that a little bit more in future sessions, but there's a little bit of an introduction there. So they're in the wilderness. Number 16, they rebel against God. We don't like this Moses. The ground opens up and swallows them up. More complaining. Oh, how come Moses, you know, gets to do all these things? They fire from God gets them. They're just grumbling, you know? Is grumbling okay? After all, aren't most of the Psalms lament Psalms? What does God think about grumbling? He doesn't think very highly of it. In the wilderness. And here's why it took Moses 40 years to lead his people out of the wilderness. It's mostly due to this long line in front of the ladies' bathroom, you know? No, I'm just kidding. Now, there's a little chart there in your notes about grumbling in the wilderness. Israel's complaint, Moses' response, God's response. Wow. It's just over and over and over. And we see these same concepts continue on as we get in the New Testament. Okay, friends, skip. I'm going to jump to the end. They end up sinning at Moab. I'm on slide 122 now. So there's this whole narrative about Balak and Balaam trying to get God to turn against Israel. Friends, it fails because God has promised to actually bless these people. And so the Balaam narrative, Balak fails to turn God against Israel. And here we find what I would call the second key verse. Numbers 23, 19 to 20, slide 129. God's not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should change his mind. Does he speak and then not act? Does he promise and not fulfill? I've received a command to bless. He is blessed, and I cannot change it. So we see, despite Israel's sin, and the fact that there's discipline, God still remains faithful to the people. And so, really what we find in the Numbers 26 to 36 is God rewards our faithfulness. All right, there's really our third thing there. So, Leviticus talks about the nation's worship. Numbers talks about the walk. God prepared Israel to walk with him, and yet he postponed their entrance in the land through unbelief. And then yet God prepared the new generation to enter the land. And throughout the whole narrative, what we see the Lord doing is the Lord is preparing them. The Lord is faithful throughout that whole time. They end up with about the same amount of people. They've lost a couple thousand, maybe 1,800. That is God's faithfulness to not destroy the people. And thus the book ends with them poised, ready to go into the land, but they're going to need to see the Lord do some amazing things on their behalf before going in through what Moses has to share with them. But here's the main idea of Numbers. God organizes, warns, and rewards us to be prepared for service. We see him organizing us to be holy. We see him warning us at the cost of unbelief. But then there's this sense of God rewarding our faithfulness at the end. All right? So how do we be prepared? Well, realize that God's given you everything you need to do his will, but disobedience deserves discipline. And God will get his will done either through you or in spite of you. So are you characterized by commitment or complaining? Here's a book that has a very, very low view of complaining against God. So be prepared. How is God directing or warning you right now? How is he saying, go this way? Or how is he saying, oh, don't go this way? May I encourage you that God's prepared you to do exactly what he wants you to do. Follow him. Don't be like these people in Numbers 13 who know exactly what the will of God is and they go, oh, no, not going to do that. And then they end up experiencing God's discipline as a result.